Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskans.
Welcome to Chinook Patterns. I'm Paula Schiller with another program looking into the four regions where the Cooperative Park Studies Unit has done work on 14H1 sites. Under ANCSA, the regional corporations are entitled to select historic and culturally significant sites. Every region has its own site characteristics. Some are compact village sites, some are prehistoric, and in the case of the Seward Peninsula, some are fairly recent, like those associated with reindeer herding. Bill Shepherd spent last summer on the Seward Peninsula and explains that it's up to the people in the region to decide the importance of each site.
What's probably unique about Seward Peninsula is that the way the people have approached the ecology of their area can differ very radically between just a 20-mile area. And so each area around a village has its own uniqueness.
For instance, can you sort of describe something for us so we can...
Well, there are many, many sites which each have an importance to the system. Relatively few sites that, in terms of subsistence, would be outstandingly important because their subsistence system is so varied.
So
they utilize so many resources. Mm-hmm. But each of these sites, despite the level of contribution, you might say, to the system or the people, is very important.
So it'd be a case where you need to look at all... several small ones, and it makes up a sort of a huge system rather than each site being vitally important.
That's right. Well, archaeology in the past has tended to look at very large village sites, and that has given a very skewed representation of what things are really like. So there has been a tendency to talk about the significance of a particular site, viewing it in the context of major village sites, like the sites on Cape Denby, which have, at least archaeologically, become very well known, neglect the importance of the smaller sites. But that's really an unfair thing to do, and you can't acquire a good understanding of everything that way.
It sounds like kind of an endless chain, though, that you're working on. The more you find, the more you find you need to find. Is that at all true? When you've got
You don't need to find everything. No archaeologist attempts to do that. What you need to do is have a sample and try to have that sample representative of all aspects of the culture. Now, of course, in 14H1 we have limitations in terms of what people felt was significant and what they nominated. And
like what?
Well, some sites are important because they have been traditional fishing sites. Other sites may be the location of a myth, the setting of a myth. There are stories of battles with various enemies and...
Would those be included in 14H?
Both
yes. Kinds?
The criteria that we have to work with in terms of assessing the significance of the site is, first of all, whether it's associated with the traditions and cultural practices of the people. And secondly, whether or not people have important feelings about a place.
That must be hard to find out.
Well, it is. You know, it's a very subjective thing. There are certain things, I think, that help you tell how people have important feelings about the site. One of them is just how well the knowledge is preserved over time. I've surveyed sites where the actual use of the site probably stopped around the turn of the century. However, the name of the site is preserved, and the way the site was used is preserved as part of the oral history. And I find that one of the most useful ways to deal with that. Another way is just looking at how a site has been used over time. Have people repeatedly gone to this place and used it, sometimes for reasons that we may not think of as economically rational.
It's a good place to go, or it's an important place to go.
Well, people definitely develop attachments over places. I know of sites where the actual resources available have changed over time, and those uses have been inappropriate. But people continue to go to these places and develop them for other uses. And some of this is reflected in the native allot process. People have selected their allotments on the basis of their feelings towards a place and how their family or families have used it over time. Of course, those sites are outside our selections. If there's any pre-selection, then of course the things like native allotments have priority. The intent of it is that important places to people are preserved if they are outside of other avenues of selection where they will not be preserved and protected.
When Congress or the Park Service or whoever goes over the documents you submit, is there a is it hard to prove that a place may be important just because people like it or it's been a favorite place to go, even though it doesn't have any economic rationality behind it? Is it easier to prove a gravesite or an old village site than it is a myth setting, for instance?
Well, some of these questions remain unanswered as yet. The process of getting the reports done, having them go through the various legal channels that needs to be done, is just beginning. And what we do need are some test cases. In some cases, maybe this will come out in a negative fashion, but that remains to be seen. The criteria that we are dealing with are fairly open, and I think that's good, because there is the risk of imposing non-native anthropological, archaeological criteria on things which may not coincide with their view of history or culture. And that would be very unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
We have, or at least where I've worked, we have developed sort of a four-stage methodology. And we usually start off by just in villages, generally talking to people about the sites and trying to get some of the, the feeling for the whole area. And when we actually start surveying sites, then we like to take informed people out to these places, and we find that the actually being at a site brings back a lot of memories, and in terms of just finding out about one specific place, it's really useful. after that, then we do a pretty standard archaeological survey and in cooperation with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And, of course, after that, then we go through the process of writing it up.
Hmm.
But
the fun part is going out to the site with the people and sitting down.
Yes.
And saying.
Yeah. Drinking a lot of coffee and just talking. And usually we talk about a lot of things related to the site and find out, you know, how one site related to another. For instance, one site may be a place where people have left kayaks before they go caribou hunting. And then we'll go to another site, and that may have been a lookout for the caribou hunters. And I've been pretty fortunate in my work that I have gotten some sample of the diversity of the sites, and that tells you quite a bit. So there's a lot of useful things come out of it, along with the preservation of the historic sites. Or at least useful mm-hmm. things to an anthropologist who wants to learn about the area.
And that information goes in the reports that you would be working out on each site, or is it something that has to come later, some of that amplification and the details? Does that just have to come with somebody else's work, or can you get that all into 14H?
Well, we have some pretty serious time limitations on you know, what you can put into a report. You, of course, can't do a little ethnography on the area. However, it's very important in talking about the significance of a site to try to capture where the site fits in those cultural traditions. And I think you have to demonstrate that before you can talk about significance. So there is, you know, not perhaps a picture of the whole culture of a particular area, but some discussion of the aspects mm-hmm. of the culture that surround a particular site.
Well, the biggest complaint that that I hear more often is for people that are collecting oral history, any kind of data, is that people come, collect all the stuff, and disappear or
yes,
never see it again.
Yes, that's very true. I'm very conscious of that. If nothing else, I've made a number of friends out there, and I'd like to see them. I think it is a problem with anthropologists. They have you know, gone in, got the information, did their dissertation, and got out. And it's very important to maintain contacts and make people feel that they're a part of it all. I think that our job is fortunate in that we can, in the process of going out and doing field work again in an area, renew contacts and make people feel they're not exploited. There is the basic value in what we're doing, and it is for them. I think many people realize that the project and their participation in it is is helping preserve their traditions.
It's probably fun for everybody involved, too, to go out there and look at this stuff. Even mm-hmm. besides the work aspect and the value of it, it's probably just a nice thing to do.
Yeah, you get to see a lot of beautiful places and meet a lot of interesting people. It's the sort of job that most people would probably pay to go do, mm-hmm. at least during the summer.
Bill Shepherd of the Cooperative Park Studies Unit. He says it's the winter's paperwork that's the tough part of the job. Next week, we go into the interior. For Chinook, I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook Patterns. I'm Paula Schiller. The Cooperative Park Studies Unit on the University of Alaska campus in Fairbanks is surveying 14H1 sites under a provision of ANCSA. The Park Studies Unit has published a newsletter about their activities. On the cover is a picture of a survey team and a group of Native resource specialists at Old John's Cabin near Arctic Village. David Libby is in the picture, and he's part of the team working in the Doyon region.
Arctic Village is just one of the areas, and it's the one that we started in with the idea of beginning in the northeast section of the Doyon area, and then working our way down throughout the next few years. So we're going to spend, we spent last summer, last field season there, and there are still more sites, but we'll have to range out further from the village this year, and we'll be getting into the wildlife range also. To completely cover the Arctic Village area. And then we'll be moving south from there, probably not this summer, but next summer. I don't know if where we'll be based after Arctic Village, perhaps Vinatai, or maybe as far down as Fort Yukon.
So there are 20 sites in the Arctic Village area.
We looked at 20 sites last year. We'll be looking at probably 20 more this year. And that's only a very small fraction of the actual number of sites. I couldn't even begin to guess how many hundreds or thousands of sites there would be around the Arctic Village area. When we were looking at sites last year, we had to kind of draw the limit at the boundaries of a site, because it's almost as if you could walk just from one site to the next and almost have a continuous site on the high ground, just ranging out in any direction from the village, so that we have to limit ourselves.
Hmm. What
and
kind of sites
that.
Then?
A lot of them are fish camps,
hmm.
There would probably be some hunting camps.
The one that I've been reading about is Old John's Cabin.
Yeah, that was one of my most interesting sites, and one that's very important to the people. The Old John Cabin site is at Old John Lake. So historically, it's a very important area to the Arctic Village people. And Old John himself was a very interesting person. He was a shaman who converted to Christianity sometime around the turn of the century, or perhaps in the latter part of the last century. And another man, somewhat older than Old John, but they were friends, a man named Trotsia, had previously been to Old Crow, associated with the white men there, the Canadians, and learned how to build a log cabin, what the people refer to as English style. That is, the joints weren't simple saddle notch, they were mortise and tenon joints at the corners of the building. He learned how to build this type of cabin, came back to Old John Lake, although it wasn't known as Old John Lake at that time. I think it was called Big Lake, and built the first Western style log cabin somewhere in the area of Old John Lake. We don't know exactly where. He later on abandoned that cabin, and Old John disassembled it and moved it down closer to the lake, to an area about a mile up from the lake where the people had always liked to camp, and where Inupiat Eskimo periodically came, particularly around Christmas time, to trade with the Nitsai Kuchin. He set up his cabin, rebuilt his cabin in that spot as a likely place, since people congregated there, and used it as a kind of Bible school or church to preach the new religion, which the people and the people from in the area and the people from the North Coast were quite enthusiastic about the new religion. Well, they were quite interested in the Bible, in the book, and some of the preachers I learned how to read English from the Bible. A successor to old John was Albert Tritt, another very interesting man from the Arctic Village area, who also was a shaman, and during a trip to Fort Yukon when he was a young man, he went to the mission service, and was quite impressed with the mission, and perhaps with the service itself. He was very interested in the missionaries' attempts to put the Kuchin language into writing using our alphabet. That was one thing that he found very interesting. He went back to Arctic Village and in the classic manner went on a solitary trip out to the mountains and had a vision and converted to Christianity. And from that time on, he worked at various projects in an attempt to consolidate the people into a group effort, building up solidarity. The first idea he had was to build a caribou fence. Now, a caribou fence was a corral-type structure that V's out for several miles in two directions and kind of channels or funnels itself towards the head. And these have historically and prehistorically been used to trap caribou. During the caribou migration times, the people would station themselves near these fences and drive the caribou into them up toward the head where they had snares. And then when the caribou were trapped, they would spear them and cut them up there. Well, Albert Tritt's idea was to surround a mountain, a small mountain called Tiki So, with one of these corral-type fences, and then herd the caribou into it, close off the fence, and keep a living herd on tap for the Arctic Village people. He started this project in 1914 and tried to enthuse the people in the village to work with him, but he only got one other man and his family to help him. But between the two of them, they built over a mile of fence. They would have had to build probably 7 or 8 more miles of fence to really surround the mountain. They worked on it, I think, three summer seasons. And then gave up on the project. He wasn't able to get the rest of the people in the village enthusiastic on the idea. He and his helper during the winter lived out near where they were building the fence, and during the winter time they studied the Bible together. Albert Tritt then, a few years later, built the first church in Arctic Village, and he did get the help of other people on that project. He also had a vision of that he got from the Bible of a straight road going from Arctic Village to Fort Yukon, and he did enthuse the people in working on that project, starting to build a straight road from Arctic Village to Fort Yukon, a really monumental task.
I didn't mention.
Another task that was abandoned, but they did get several miles of road constructed before they abandoned that project.
When you went to
to look at old John's cabin, what kind of shape was it in? How did you find out what you were looking at, for instance, and what was there?
Well, all the sites that we looked at had previously been put on the map. When we went out to old John's cabin, we were able to take, very fortunate to be able to take some of the older people who had lived there at the turn of the century. We took Sarah Frank, who now lives in Venetai. She's 94 years old and is a daughter of old John. And we were able to take Myra Kay, who was visiting from Old Crow. She's approximately 97 years old and is a niece of Trotsia, the original builder of the cabin. We had several other people with us, too, who had been related to old John, but these were the oldest people that we had. And both Myra Kay and Sarah Frank had lived in the cabin when they were kids. So they were able to tell us a lot about the history of the place and about its significance. We traveled around in a helicopter last summer, so it was relatively easy to take anyone that we needed out to the site. We could just fly into the village and pick up these elderly people who otherwise probably never would have gotten a chance to go back to these sites, and take them right out there on the spot. Old John's wife, that would be Sarah Frank's mother, had died near Old John's cabin, probably around 1915. We don't know the date exactly. And Sarah had never been to the grave since the time of the burial. So we were able to fly her down to the grave, and she was quite happy to be there. She otherwise probably never would have seen her mother's grave again.
It looks like fun. We've got pictures from the newsletter about old John's cabin, and everybody looks like they're having kind of a nice time poking around the old cabin and talking
about
it.
Yeah, they did. They had a very good time. We were able to take, I guess it must be about 10 of the older people that we were able to take up there by helicopter. And one of the ladies, as soon as she got out of the helicopter, had a bunch of traps and her .22 rifle with her, and she went off looking for a good place to set up the traps for ground squirrels. The older people in the area really like to eat ground squirrels. And one of the reasons that old John liked that particular locality for the cabin was because it was known for as a good trapping place for ground squirrels. So Alice Peter, when she got out of the helicopter, immediately went out to try to get some ground squirrels. She didn't get any, though.
David Libby of the Cooperative Park Studies Unit. And this is the last of a series looking at what the anthropologists and archaeologists are doing in the regions where they're surveying 14H1 sites. For Chinook, I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.